Amen. Thank you, Reed. Good morning. Welcome, everyone. It's good to be with you again. Good to see you, as always. We've mentioned in this class before how the Bible says that the fool says in his heart, there is no God. And I was thinking about that, and you know, just because I don't say there is no God, that is, just because I say or acknowledge that there is a God, does not therefore make me wise. The fool says there is no God, but even if I acknowledge God, even if I recognize that there must be a God, that in and of itself does not negate my foolishness. I could still be a fool and believe in God. The psalmist goes on in Psalm 110 and 111 and verse 10 and says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So if I want to reject foolishness and come to wisdom, that requires not only that I believe in God, but that I go the additional step to a healthy and appropriate and right fear of the Lord. It requires fear of the Lord. And by the way, the passage says the fear of the Lord, and I remember Gene pointing this out, Gene West. He said, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's where we get on the train. That's where we start to be wise, is when we come to an appropriate, healthy fear of God. I want to pick up last week where we left off. And we talked last week about three barriers that atheism must climb. This was a slide that I stole from someone years ago when it was presented to me. But I think it's a helpful slide because it gives us a way to orient a conversation with friends and neighbors as we talk about atheism, as we talk about, in particular, evolution, as we will today. There are three barriers that atheism must climb and get over, and they are these. Atheism must explain why there is something rather than nothing, and how it is that something resulted from nothing. It must explain how it is that life came about, organization necessary for life, from non-life, from non-living things. And finally, it has to explain how that simple life became complex life, how it somehow developed into what we see around us today. It's this third point that brings out the notion of evolution. That is, how could simple life produce complex life? We're going to say it again in a minute, but evolution only endeavors to explain how life could develop from pre-existing life. That is, how more complex life could come about from pre-existing life. It does not make any attempt to explain the origin of life. Evolution can only work, supposedly, on pre-existing life forms that are already self-replicating. So it says nothing about the development of life from non-living matter. But briefly, let's summarize what we said last time. What we worked our way through was basically the following. And we're asking as we go through this summary and through these ideas whether evolution is adequate as an explanation. Is it sufficient to explain the things that it sets out to explain? In the first place, we said that the theory of evolution is atheism's response to teleology. No one, Christian or atheist or non-Christian, theist, whatever camp you fall into, no one can deny that there is tremendous complexity and organization in the realm of life in particular. No one can deny it. And so on atheism, the response that's put forward is the theory of evolution. Somehow life got going at the beginning. We can imagine that as, or they imagine that as a small step to get single cellular life, and then evolution took over and produced all of the variety and creativity and complexity that we see in the living realm today. So the theory of evolution is, you might say, atheism's response or explanation of teleology. A famous scientist has said Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. This is actually the second half of a quote. The first part says something like atheism was perhaps logically tenable before Darwin, but Darwin came along and made it possible not just to logically hold to the possibility of atheism, but now to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. That is, you can be scientifically oriented. You can be consider yourself an intellectual person and be, at the same time, an atheist. Secondly, we said, the theory of evolution did not begin with Charles Darwin. And I think that's an important point to recognize. We actually went back historically to the book of Genesis, and we talked about the idea that atheism for a while after the creation would have been literally impossible. How several generations would have had to have passed before anyone could even begin to deny the existence of God. Why? Because those alive at the beginning were in intimate communion with God himself. And so God was directly accessible, directly available to them, and so his existence could not have been denied. At some point, though, that changed, and men began to question God. I wonder if, before we get to the point in Genesis chapter 5 where men had begun to call on the name of the Lord, if maybe that had already happened, if people had begun to doubt the existence of God, and maybe even tried to come up with some sort of naturalistic explanation for their own existence, even that early in the history of mankind. But the theory certainly did not begin with Charles Darwin, and we talked about several scientists dating back to the 540s BC who recorded statements that look a lot like what we call the theory of evolution. It certainly did not begin with Charles Darwin. There's a book by a man named Benjamin Weicker called The Darwin Myth that exposes a lot of the mythology that has developed and been promoted around Charles Darwin. And if you're interested, I encourage you to grab that book and take a look at it. The definition we came up with for evolution, we recognize that it is loosely defined, and lots of things fall under the heading of evolution, which the word itself, of course, just means change. The definition we came to was the following: the undirected process by which all living things are thought to have developed and diversified from the first living thing. And there's a lot there in that definition. Probably more than anything else, though, we should emphasize that it is an undirected process, an undirected process, as we think about whether or not it is an adequate theory to explain what it's supposed to explain. The mechanisms of the theory of evolution are only available once life exists. We pointed that out already. Natural selection acting on mutation, random variation and mutation, can only occur once there is something reproducing itself. And so life is a prerequisite for the theory of evolution. And finally, we recognize that every marvel of the physical realm of life has to be explained by the theory of evolution. There can be no exceptions. If there is a single exception, a single physical exception to what can be explained by random processes and subsequent natural selection acting on them, then evolution is not sufficient as an explanation for life. A single exception would certainly undo it. So we talked about then the mechanisms of evolution. We'll quickly go through this and get into new material. The mechanism of evolution is essentially selection acting on variation. So there is variability as we go from one generation to the next. And then among those competing options, especially if there's competition for food resources and other resources, the most fit organism will be selected from among its compadres. And so there will be a selection that comes from the variation. In a little more detail, what happens supposedly, is that mutation occurs in the DNA of a reproductive cell. So the reproductive cell is important here because it's in those cells that traits and mutations will be passed on to progeny. So mutation has to occur in a reproductive cell. That's a change, you might say, in the genetic code that is contained in the DNA. So mutation appears accidentally, in an undirected way, without intention. It simply makes a copying error. Secondly, the new organism is born with this variant set of DNA. So its genetic information is different from that of its parent DNA. Or its parent's DNA. So the new organism is a variant, variation, mutant, whatever you want to call it. It has a different set of instructions. Those instructions then inform how the organism will be built and what it will look like. It will, because it has a different set of instructions, be built differently. And then the theory says, if that variation is beneficial, it will be selected in the sense that it survives to produce offspring of its own, and that offspring will look like itself and then pass on that whatever desirable trait that it inherited as a result of the mutation. So if it's beneficial, it will survive to reproduce, and that is the essential mechanism of evolution, selection acting on variation. We talked last time, and I don't want to reiterate those, but we talked last time about the sorts of analogies that are given to explain evolution. We talked about the idea of an eagle that had, let's say, longer claws, just to simplify things, that made it more able to hold on to food, made it therefore more able to capture food, more able therefore to survive, more likely to survive, and so that characteristic was passed on to subsequent generations. There are many examples of this. We also mentioned the finches that Darwin supposedly studied, although that is a part of the mythology. He did not study those finches himself. They weren't studied until more than 100 years after his trip. But these finches have different shaped beaks and different sized beaks. The ones with larger beaks, let's say, were more able to crack open seeds and then, you know, have access to food. Therefore, they were more likely to survive. Did survive and passed on that trait. And so there is an example, supposedly, of evolution. But I want to look at evolution in reality and try to bring things down to the ground a little bit and get away from analogy, although we will use analogies as we go forward, but to look at what are more realistic analogies that address the inherent problems with the theory. There are two fundamental problems we should look at. That we should study, and they are these. First of all, evolution is unable to generate useful variations. It's unable to generate them. The only mechanism that's put forward in an undirected random scheme is accidental copy errors in the DNA. As in the process of copying a DNA, a mistake is made, and copying error is made. And that is the only source of new variation. The only source of new variation. Now, Charles Darwin, when he took his tour around the world in the 1830s and studied a variety of plants and animals, as we talked about last time, did not know about DNA. He had no idea about it. No one in the world did at the time. It had never been directly observed. There was no awareness of this alphabet of life, of these instructions of life. And so when he studied and talked about variations, the way in which he did that was, you might say, very loose. He just imagined that an organism has, let's say, a dozen offspring at a time, and the organism and the offspring have variations from one to the next. There was no explanation, no actual biological explanation for the variations. He just allowed himself to discuss these things as if they would occur naturally. We understand now that variation only exists if it's encoded into the DNA, and therefore a variation would have to result from some kind of a copying error that gives new information, new set of instructions. Evolution cannot generate new useful variations. And secondly, The variations which could lead to new information, could lead to new, let's say, biological function or biological information, are too small very often to be selected. And we'll talk about both of these things in some detail, but the idea is very often what happens is a mutation occurs and it has so little effect on the organism that it cannot be selected by natural selection. It doesn't change the organism in a substantial enough way that it confers enough benefit on the organism to separate it from its you might say, siblings. So there are two things going on here. First of all, we cannot generate new useful variations, and secondly, the variations that do appear, the mutations that do appear, are not selectable. They cannot be reached by natural selection. So we need to say something more about mutations. Mutations are the source of new information, the only source of new information that is put forth on evolution. So what do we know about mutations? Well, mutations come in various forms. There are several listed here. They include the following and others. Point mutation is where a single letter is exchanged for another letter in the genetic alphabet. So as copying is being done, a certain point in the code is being copied, and a single mistake is made, then the sequence picks up right where it left off, and you're none the wiser. But in the process, a single point at a single position on the DNA, a mistake or a change is made. That's called a point mutation. There are also insertion and deletion mutations, where a chunk of DNA is inserted at some position in an existing strand of DNA. Again, this is random, this is unintentional, it's accidental, it is undirected, but a chunk of DNA, maybe 50 or 100 base pairs, something like this, is inserted or deleted from the DNA in the process of copying. Sometimes DNA is reversed, and so it's copied into a sequence in the reverse order. So you have forward-facing DNA, and then a chunk that has been reversed, and then back to the same forward direction copying. That's called a reversal. Another kind of mutation is a duplicated sequence where a strand of DNA will be copied two or three times and inserted then into the DNA. That's a kind of insertion mutation. And so there are multiple kinds of mutations, but in every case, you should ask yourself, and we should ask ourselves, is there new information present? Is there something new being generated? Is there something genuinely, functionally useful that's resulting from this sort of accidental, blind process? Secondly, the detectability, or the consequences, you might say, of a mutation vary from almost undetectable. It's hard to imagine any mutation in a functional system being not at all harmful. But you can imagine a change, a point mutation, for example, that has almost no harmful effect for the organism. The organism is none the wiser as it goes about its business of living. It is maybe undetectable or as close to being undetectable as can be, as inconsequential as can be, even though, again, a mistake cannot really be without harm. But you could have a mutation that's almost undetectable or inconsequential, and then there is a spectrum of consequence here for mild and moderate, and then, of course, in the most extreme case, a mutation will end the life, will terminate the life of an organism. And so there is a range of harm, a range of consequence for various mutations. Another interesting thing we need to point out is that there is no known unambiguously beneficial mutation. And that's not because scientists aren't looking for them. There is a fine network that exists of scientists who are looking for beneficial mutations to occur, to pop up. No unambiguously beneficial mutations are known to exist, and we'll talk about this more as we go. Secondly, we need to recognize that mutations are extraordinarily rare. We're talking a lot about mutations. We're talking about them as the generator of new information that produces new life forms and new instructions for new life form, but we should recognize that they are extraordinarily rare. The estimates vary dramatically, so I don't know why that is. I am not at all an expert on any of these things, but there is quite a range of postulated mutation rates. One suggestion from 2009, published in Nature, which is considered to be a high quality journal. One in 30 million base pair copies will be a mistake, an error. So you might have a point mutation out of 30 million letters in this alphabet as it's being copied, a single mistake. Other estimates are 1 in 100 million. I've seen estimates as high as 1 in 10 billion, 1 in 10 billion. And so estimates are all over the place, but at any rate, they are extraordinarily rare. So think about that just on the surface. We're talking about the explanation for all of life, all the complexity of complex life, falling back to such a rare and extraordinarily rare occurrence as random change, chance change in a single position once every 30 million times, and that being the explanation for the complexity of life. But in the third place, mutations, when they occur, are harmful. A distribution looks something like this. And by the way, in a lot of simulations that you hear being done in this realm, there is a normal distribution that's used to explain the harm or benefit of a mutation. That is, with a standard normal distribution, you have a 50% chance of being positive, that is 50% chance of having a beneficial mutation, and a 50% chance of being harmful. That is not at all the case. And that's known. It's known to not at all be the case in the scientific community. The distribution is more like this, and maybe exactly like this, but we have to admit that there's something, some small benefit over here, very close to zero. So there's something there. So it's not quite exactly this, but it's close enough to this to be considered accurate. So the picture here is on the scale on the bottom, there is benefit or harm. So on the left side of the scale would be harm, on the right side of the scale would be benefit. The distribution is nearly almost all on the harmful side. What you see also in the picture is that typically, the more typical mutation falls close to neutral. Neutral would be right here in the middle. And so the majority of the mutations are almost unnoticeable, or effectively neutral. Although there are a few mutations, the curve gets lower toward the tail, there are a few mutations that are devastating to the organism and severe. So this is the picture that shows a distribution of the harm of mutation. In the fourth place, mutations, to be beneficial, to accomplish anything, require not just a single point mutation. By the way, even those are extraordinarily rare. But to be beneficial, it requires multiple coordinated changes to bring about even a single new protein. Now remember, a protein, which we've talked about before, is not new function. It's not as if a whale has gone to being a land-dwelling organism just because it has a new protein. Not even close. But even to get a new protein, multiple coordinated changes are required. Take a quick example, and I apologize for the numbers, but imagine a single protein consisting of 100 amino acids, just to take a simple example. 100 amino acid protein is considered to be small. It takes three letters in the DNA to code for a single amino acid. And if you have 100 amino acids and they have to be in a certain order, certain position, exactly the right amino acid, there are 300 base pair point mutations that would have to occur. Now, you could put all 300 of those in a single generation. It's just that the chances of that occurring are so extraordinarily small that it's not even worth talking about. And no one does talk about such a thing. Always we're talking about gradual changes, gradual benefit, one at a time. 300 base pairs must mutate in the right relative positions. So imagine a 300 base pair string of DNA. You don't have to change them all at once. You could change position 25 and then position 78. And you could change these one at a time as you go down through the eons of time until all 300 base pairs are in the right position. Then that protein will appear. But the probability of that happening, of getting all of those choices in the right position, is enormous, enormously small, I should say. If there are 20 amino acids, which is approximately the number that show up in life, 20 amino acids to choose from, and you have 300 positions, that brings us to something like 10 to the negative 391st power, which is a decimal point with 391 zeros followed by a 1. And so enormously, enormously small probabilities. But a protein, and again, I almost apologize for making this point again and again, but a protein is just a piece in any biological pathway. A protein may be coordinating one of the arrows in a diagram like this. So this is a biological pathway that has something to do with mitochondria, which has to do with energy production in a single cell. And so this is a pathway that's involved. There are processes here going on that are just incredibly complex, involving hundreds or thousands of proteins just to accomplish whatever this particular pathway may happen to be. And so the level of coordination required here is staggering. It's just staggering. But we can only be interested in, we're only interested in, good mutations. So we've talked about the distribution of mutations, how they are almost always deleterious, almost always harmful. But we're interested in, we need good mutations for life to progress, for any benefit to be conferred to an organism. That good mutation has to appear so that the organism can be plopped into the environment, be more likely to survive, therefore survive, and then pass on its greater level of fitness to its offspring. But what about complex mutations? What happens when we change something in a complex system? In a complex system, we know, just from analogy even, although again, analogies can be dangerous, but analogies can teach us things as well. In a complex system, random change is almost always harmful. I talked last week about the water pump in my car that I thought I got a good deal on, and if I had installed it, would have destroyed the engine because it wouldn't fit. It just wouldn't fit. And dozens of variables were correct on the water pump, but a single change, a single mistake, made it altogether worthless and ineffective. But take a book. How likely is it that if you take a book which involves words and paragraphs and sentence structure and grammatical structure and organization into chapters and so forth, and you randomly change, or I randomly change letters in that book. Maybe I take the third chapter and duplicate it and have chapter 3 and then 3 prime and then 4, just an identical copy of chapter 3. Does that improve the quality or the readability? Whatever your notion of natural selection is there, does it improve the likelihood of the book to sell? Does it improve the quality of the read, the impact that the book has on you as you read it? Does it improve any of these things if we make random changes to a book? Does a computer program benefit if we make a random change to the code of the program? If you've done any computer programming at all, you know how delicate and how sensitive these things are, even to the case of a letter. If a letter is capitalized when it should be lowercase, the computer has no idea what you are talking about and will send an error. What about a mousetrap? If you make a change, a random change to a mousetrap, which you might say is a simple organism, and Michael Behe talks about the mousetrap in his book, Darwin's Black Box, the mousetrap, he says, is irreducibly complex in the sense that if you make a single change to a mousetrap, to any of the features of a mousetrap, its function is destroyed. It is worthless for its intended purpose. In complex systems, random change is so close to always being harmful that I should take out the almost. We should just say it's always harmful because it's so close to accurate, even though we can imagine maybe in the most extreme stretches of the imagination some random change being helpful. But in reality, complex systems are balanced and they are delicate. So the conclusion then is that any change that's made, any change that appears, has to be carefully coordinated with the structure that's already present. If a change occurs in my DNA that causes a cell in my body to exude some dangerous chemical, the rest of my body is going to suffer. If any change occurs that's harmful to any other system in my body, then overall, there's a net loss of fitness, net loss of viability, or whatever term you want to use. Third, there are no known instances of random change producing functional information, not just in biology, but in our experience as a whole. There is no known instance of random change, random jiggling of parameters or information itself, random change does not produce new functional useful information. You can tell a computer program to duplicate the phrase today is Sunday again and again and again, but that's not a generation of new information. That's a generation of just a copy of a small amount of information. There's a book by a guy named Werner Gitt. He must be Russian because he has a Russian accent. I don't know. But his book is called In the Beginning Was Information, and he talks about something. It's a new book. It came out in the last five or 10 years. But he talks about in this book what he calls laws of conservation of information. Just like we talked earlier in the class about the law of conservation of mass and the law of conservation of energy, how these things cannot be created or destroyed. He postulates the law of conservation of information. That is, without intelligence, he says, without intelligence, you never get, and there's no known instance of getting, new functional information. It never happens. Information erodes and decays, and we know this. We know this if we've ever done any copying of anything ourselves. Information does not improve with copying. So we've talked about some analogies for evolution. We talked about the eagle with the claw and other things. I want to give what I think is a better analogy. This is not mine. It came from a man named John Sanford, who used to be a biologist, a geneticist at Cornell University. He was an evolutionist, and then he, after studying what he calls the primary axiom, which is another word for the theory of evolution. It's his term, the primary axiom, he calls it. After studying it in some detail, and after his work with genetics, he realized that it cannot be possible. It cannot be the case that new information results from blind, random processes. And he gave the following analogy. He said, imagine making a wagon, like a little red flyer wagon with a handle on it. It has four wheels, a place to ride or to put things in, and you can pull it along. It steers. It has some kind of a pivot in the front so that it can be steered. But imagine that you want to improve on that wagon in the following way. You take an instruction manual that has instructions for producing the wagon, And then you make random changes to that instruction manual and then feed that manual into a machine that copies blindly. And what I mean to say is feed it into a machine that reproduces blindly according to those instructions. So you take a set of instructions, make random changes, accidental changes, copy errors, and then take that new set of instructions, put it into a machine that produces a new wagon according exactly to your new instructions. So a machine takes instructions, produces a wagon exactly according to those instructions, even if they're absurd, even if a copying error has deleted a whole section. Okay, so the machine does its best to produce the wagon according to the instructions, and then you put it on the market to sell. And this is the parallel notion to natural selection. So we make a mutation in the instructions, produce something according to the instructions, and then put it out on the market and see if it sells. If it sells better, then we're going to make more of those wagons. And so that wagon's instructions will show up and start to maybe attain a greater market share of the wagons that are available. And then those instructions will be duplicated again, and potentially errors will be made in the copying process, and so that new wagons can be produced. Okay? But remember, the requirement here, and this is what is elusive to a lot of people, I think, a lot of people who think about these things, is that when the copying is done, the process is random, it is non-intelligent, it is arbitrary, it is an accidental change that is made along the way. There is no direction, there is no design. And you think back to this idea of 300 base pairs that need to be put, say, in a certain order to produce a new protein. When a single change is made in that 300 base pair process, you cannot know that you're on your way to success. You cannot know that that new change is a positive change. You only know that it's a change. You cannot look ahead to the eventual 300 base pair change that's desired. You can only go a step at a time. You can only go randomly and blindly into the future. That's hard for intelligent beings, I think, to wrap our minds around the notion of pure randomness. What do you expect with such a wagon? Do you expect the wagon gets better? Do you expect it improves? Now, the analogy that John Sanford gives is this. He says, imagine taking a wagon with its instruction, making random changes, and requiring that wagon to, over a process of as much time as you want to invoke, producing a space shuttle or something with an engine and a rocket and place for a pilot to ride and all of this. Imagine such a change. You might imagine something like this. So there's a wagon that exists and it has instructions for producing it. The instructions in one part say bend metal that is 0.05 inches thick by 12.2 inches wide by 38.5 inches long in half along its shorter dimension through an angle of some number of degrees. Okay, maybe that's a part of the instructions. And then imagine that in the positions that I've underlined, a random error is made. Maybe the first zero to the right of the decimal point there is changed to a 3. So instead of metal that's 0.05 inches thick, now you have metal that is 0.35 inches thick. Would a red wagon made out of metal that's almost a half an inch thick be marketable? Would it be useful? Would it be valuable? Okay. What if instead of a 1 in the 12, there is now a 0? So instead of 12.2 inches wide, the wagon is, or the piece of metal is 2.2 inches wide. Is that likely to produce a better wagon? Again, we're making these changes randomly. There is no design, no intention going on. What if instead of using the shorter dimension, we use the longer dimension? What if instead of degrees, we measure this in radians or some other angle measure? What if any of these positions change? Is it likely to produce a better wagon? By such shuffles, John Sanford said, we must produce a space shuttle. Now, there is selection going on. If the wagon gets a little bit better, it will sell better, presumably. It will be more marketable. And so such wagons will become more common, and people will love them, and they will be seen and appear. But is such a process reasonably capable of going from something like a wagon to something like a motorcycle or an automobile or something like this? We're almost out of time. I want to look at a couple of objections. First of all, there is the objection of similarity. Folks say, someone will say, because there is similarity in organisms, say between human beings and primates, monkeys, such things, because of this similarity, that implies a developmental relationship. And we're out of time, so we'll have to pick up with this next time. Let's suffice to say now that similarity could just as likely be explained by a common designer who is interested in using similar designs for similar purposes. Thank you for your attention.